Well, I was on vacation last week. I came in this past weekend to pick up my mail and see if any books came in for me, and a whole bunch did, including the translator, the proof of the translator. So Sunday night, I sat down and started to read it, and loved it. So Monday morning, I called, and I noticed the little flyer in there, and it said Ward Just will be in town on the 11th and 12th. Boy, that doesn't give me much time. I mean, that gives me about 2 days.
But, exactly.
It was so, I was enjoying it so much.
I'm glad you liked it.
Just had to come in, even though I didn't have as much time to prepare. And apparently this is a real, what is an unexpected trip into New York?
No, we'd laid this on, a couple of weeks ago, I guess. And it was just 2 days only because there wasn't all that much doing here. We're going down to Washington where there's more going on with, in terms of interviews and whatnot. I'm surprised you only got the proofs now. It should have been, you should have gotten those long before. I shall speak to my publicity agent.
Well, the proof probably came sometime last week.
Yeah, should have been there 3 months ago. Well, that's life, you know.
I'm supposed to be doing Norman Mailer. They sent they had 125 galleys sent out, and they didn't send me one. The galleys, they said, were $30 each.
They're charging for the galleys.
Cost random house $30 each. They claim for the galleys. So that's why they didn't send me one. They sent them to the more influential critics, however. The book won't be ready until, I believe, about 4 days before Mailer starts his tour. Now, this is a book called Harlot's Ghost, and it's 1,100 pages.
Yeah, I know. It's a very, very long book.
And nobody's going to have time to prepare for that novel.
No, impossible.
They're late distributing the book.
Yeah. Well, they want it out for Christmas. That's the... You know, I mean, that's, you put the kind of advance that they've got out on Mailer and the sort of commitment they're making for the book. It's got to be a Christmas book because that's when, you know, most of the books are sold in the United States.
When is the pub date for the translator?
It was 2 days ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I thought I was getting you really early.
Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of book that only you could have written. I couldn't write a book like that. It takes someone who has been in Europe, and I know that you spend a good portion of your time in Paris, so you know the locales and know the kinds of people that you have written about. There are some wonderful things in the book that I've read up to this point. One of the things that I really, really liked was the description of the apartment in the book. Is this the kind of an apartment that you might have lived in at one point?
We lived in a place very much like that. I've peopled it with some fictitious characters. I've given the place a fictitious name in the novel. It's called Fortress America, with a kind of collection of odd and some not so odd people, some ordinary people, some odd people. All of whom are made up. When my wife and I were living there, it was it's a place way up in Montmartre. It's an Art Deco building with wonderful kind of curlicues and a very curvy building. I think there isn't a straight line in the entire place, which is, it's difficult to explain. It's sort of arranged on three levels, with sort of the buildings itself are kind of its spokes at one end to the other, and it's kind of an enchanted building. It's a protected building. The French have declared it in effect a kind of an historical monument, and so you can't interfere with it. You can make no changes on the outside of any kind. You can do anything you want to on the interior, but you can't do anything on the exterior. So it was a lot of fun to live there. And the woman who owned it was 98 years old. She was an opera singer who had sung at Bayreuth. She used to sing Wagner at Bayreuth. She's a very large woman, a soprano. And when she died, her son inherited the building, her apartments, and wanted to sell them. So we were forced to move, and we moved down into the center of town from up on the Butte.
Moving just a little closer to that one.
Okay.
Well, you have as your hero a German who course, at the beginning of the novel, starts off as a young boy who sees the tail end of the war in a very violent way and eventually becomes an expatriate and moves to Paris and becomes indeed a translator. How did it happen that you decided to use this particular person as your protagonist?
Expatriation interests me, whether it's people who grew up in the Middle West who end up East, or Americans who go to Europe, or indeed, in this case, Germans who go to this German particularly lives ends up in Paris. I am interested in the effects of memory and family and country on people, and it struck me as interesting a setup as you can have in 1991 with the reunification of the two Germanies. A German who would be in the year 1991, call him 55 or 56 years old, roughly the age that I am, born therefore in 1935, 5 years old at the outbreak of World War II, not at all complicit in the Third Reich. You can't be complicit in anything if you're only 5 years old. And yet one way and another meant to bear the scars of the Third Reich, meant to bear the consequences of the Third Reich, meant to contemplate what it was that your forebears did to bring that very, very dark shadow over Europe. And if you're one kind of person, German, American, French, whatever, English, you expatriate yourself. The memory either becomes too difficult or you find yourself uneasy living in the land of your birth. You expatriate yourself. So Sidney Van Damme, my character, expatriates himself to Paris, as, for quite different reasons, his wife, who is an American, has expatriated herself from the United States. So these two people who have chosen to abstract themselves from their roots, as it were, end up in Paris and end up married. And the book is some critics have not taken it this way. It's the way I mean it, for what that's worth. It's something of a love story between these two people, who are rather quiet people, as Sidney's a translator. These are not people on the fast track. Alas, events oblige them to move on to a faster track than they like, particularly Sidney. And that's how the book plays itself out, when Sidney Van Damme, the translator, finds himself moving in a world for which he is entirely and completely ill-equipped, let alone ill-prepared. His wife is a little bit more wised up than he is. I mentioned wised up women interest me. I mean, particularly women who are more wised up than the men that they're with. And that's the, in a nutshell, the background of
it. It is indeed a love story that gets off to a rather rocky start with a honeymoon in what appears to be a rather sinister German resort.
Indeed. It's a real place. It's called Zilt. Zilt is located in the Frisian Islands, right off the border of Germany and Denmark. It is, in fact, the Martha's Vineyard of Hamburg. I mean, as the Hamptons are, or the, as Martha's Vineyard is the resort of Boston, so is Zilt the resort of Hamburg. And it is a rather sinister place. My wife and I have been there, and it's a very odd. I've never been to a resort quite like it. There are no, very, very few foreigners ever go there. It is strictly a kind of a German hangout, which does lend it to often a kind of a sinister air, but it's also got its sort of jolly aspect. In any event, the honeymoon does begin badly because Angela, Sidney Van Damme's wife, would really much rather be in Tuscany. And let me tell you, there are no two places in Europe farther apart than the island of Zilt in the Frisian Islands and Tuscany in northern Italy. So things from their point of view things are just a tad rocky.
Well, the United States has some sinister resorts, too. I can think of Asbury Park, New Jersey, York Beach, Maine.
York Beach, Maine. I know York Beach, Maine. That's right.
That's That is certainly a honky-tonk. I remember going to York Beach and being appalled by it. Reminded me a little bit of, you should know the place, the Dells, Wisconsin.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I do know it. I do indeed. The funny thing, Zilt is not a honky-tonk place, strangely. It's almost the thing that's a little bit sinister about it is that it is really quite austere. I mean, it's very beautiful in its way. There are dunes, and the North Sea, of course, often goes into a rage in the summertime. It's a bit of a problem with all these little houses with their eyelid eyes to them.
Now you have a kind of an antagonist as well in the form of Junko Poole, who always refers to deals he can cut from Uncle Sugar. Tell me about him.
Junko is a particular type. I mean, my Junko happens to be an American, but they abound everywhere. I mean, in Europe as elsewhere, of all nationalities, and they're 10 percenters is what they are. Junko's particular conceit is that he's got what he thinks is an absolutely foolproof cover, and indeed it has proved to be a foolproof cover for him. He has allowed it to be known that he is a very, very deep cover operative, indeed, of the Central Intelligence Agency. Junko Poole doesn't have anything to do with the CIA, but if you think about it for a minute, what a wonderful cover if you're engaged in sort of dubious business ventures. Everybody assumes you've got unlimited capital, and when you're involved in business ventures, often the perception of unlimited capital isn't so far different from the reality of unlimited capital. And that's how Junko gets on in this world, in his particular enterprise in the time of the book, is that he's very interested in Eastern Europe. And as democracy and our wonderful free market economy come to Czecho and Hungary and Romania, Junko thinks he sees a way, thinks there's profit to be made by somebody who gets in there sooner and quicker than anybody else. There's just a way to strip those societies of every last remaining asset, whatever little gold bullion they've got lying around. Old Junko will see to it that, the 10% of that one way and another is his. And the plot of the book, to a degree, revolves around a particularly audacious venture that he's got going in Eastern Germany. In East Germany now, Eastern Germany. These are common types in Europe. I mean, what is the free market economy but a sort of an opportunity to make a killing? That's what it is, and that's what Junko's up to.
I guess it's the Harry Lime syndrome.
Very much, exactly.
Now, there's a subplot that fascinates me, too, in the translator, and that deals with the translation by Sidney of the fiction of the German novelist, and Sidney becomes obsessed with what this novelist is writing about. Tell me about that.
It's a little bit. It doesn't take up very much of the book, but it's a kind of a book within a book. And I became very interested when I was writing this. I was reading the German language writers, late 19th and early 20th century German language writers, and there is a bleakness and austerity to their vision and their prose as it is translated into English that I found just very attractive. And it seemed to me to be very interesting for any translator to try to take this really very thick German and to somehow present it in an English that was accessible to a common reader. And I also had a couple of other things that I had in mind. I thought that if I got this novel within a novel, down properly, correctly, that it would give people a look into the particular German psyche, which is different, needless to say, as the French psyche is, or the American, or the Canadian, or whatever. And it does not take up much of the book, but the passages that are there are just as flat and as austere and as formal as I could make them, and to somehow give a sense of the formality of the German spirit. There's differences in the German characters there are in the American or any other character, but there is often a particular kind of formality that seems to be rendered best in this kind of prose, and that was really what I was up to there.
You implied at the beginning of our conversation that Sidney must carry around with him a certain degree of guilt for the Third Reich. I've always wondered about that because growing up as I did in the late 1930s and 40s as a child, the Germans were, of course, the epitome of evil in many respects after the war, especially after finding out about the concentration camps. I have resented the Germans terribly. Strangely, my sister-in-law is a German woman. And while she is a born-again Christian and is as wonderful a person as you can ever imagine, once in a while I think about it, and I don't resent her per se, but I sometimes think about the Germans and what they did, and I resent it. And I think that's probably symptomatic of someone my age. You know what I'm saying? It's like I was talking to William Manchester, and Manchester was saying that he doesn't think he could ever forgive the Japanese, but he was a Marine in the Pacific Theater.
Yes, yes.
And doesn't think he could ever forgive the Japanese, even though he's met wonderful individual Japanese.
People our age, who grew up, in my case, from the middle 30s on and through the 40s, at this very impressionable age, the dose of propaganda on the one hand, whether it came out over radio or in the newspapers or particularly in the movies, and then to discover the Holocaust, and as you say, the concentration camps, it is very hard to expunge from your memory. You really want to turn your face from the entire German race, German nationality, rather. One can't do that. You can't. It is not right to damn an entire nation, an entire people, particularly people who were 5 years old when when all of this began. I think it has been a problem. It's a problem in Europe today. The French are very, very wary of the Germans. English are wary of the Germans. A little less wary, oddly enough, it seems to me, than the French. But then the French are right up against them. I mean, they share a common border, and Britain doesn't. All of that relates back to these memories of the war. There's no evidence, for example, in Germany today that anti-Semitism is any worse in Germany than it is in France or Great Britain. And yet, you look at Germany and the slightest incident that will happen. And sometimes the incidents are not so slight, by the way. But they're not so slight in France either, and occasionally in Britain, and sometimes in Italy. And there'll be this flurry of newspaper articles: anti-Semitism on the rise, is Hitler returning? I don't think that history ever repeats itself in that way. Germany may go on to become a beast of a country, but it'll be a beast in a different way. It won't be a beast in that way, or indeed, it may go on to be a country of with a benign spirit. It's certainly been benign enough for the last 45 years. Germany is the most tranquil and, in many ways, the most stable of the Western European states. In part, that is probably because they have not been really obliged to provide for their own defense. All they have to do is sit and make a great deal of money. The United States has provided for their defense. NATO has provided for their defense, and it's been the American Defense Department that's really armed them and whatnot. The German defense budget is very small, and they've been able to really wring that economy out. And as an economic miracle, it's really quite stunning to go to Germany and take a look at Frankfurt or Dusseldorf or Hamburg, cities of that kind.
Warren, you said a couple of minutes ago that you were fascinated by the idea of expatriates. And that must be because you yourself have been an expatriate. You have lived in France for a number of years, haven't you?
I lived in France for 5 years, and when I was a newspaper man, I lived abroad, quite a lot. So I do. I seem to have a kind of Rolling Stone mentality, or abstracted from my roots, or something. So I feel quite close to all that.
Are you still living in Paris?
Yes.
Full time or what?
Well, we're back here most of the summer, but in essence we're really residents over there.
But where do you live when you're here?
We live in Martha's Vineyard when we're here.
You have a house?
The island. Yeah, we got a little beach house.
Ah, but that's not practical for the winter.
No. no, by no means.
So that's during the winter.
Really wasn't very practical during Hurricane Bob.
So during the winter months, you go back and live in Paris.
Exactly.
I always wondered what that would be like, although I've been to Paris and London and so forth, only as a tourist. I've often wondered what it would be like to live away from the country of your birth, because you miss so many things that seem to be second nature to you. And what is it like exactly? How do you get accustomed to another culture after your entire background of living in your home nation?
Well, I live on the margins in Paris very much. I don't speak the language well at all. I've been terribly productive since I've been to Paris. I use it as a working environment, believe it or not. It's odd to think that you go to Paris and that's what you do there is work. But that's what I tend to do. And for me, the value of it is the distance from the United States. Because I write about American topics. I really don't write about European topics. This book, my book, The Translator, is very much of a departure for me. Even so, the book is essentially a book that is an American book. It's an American novel. It's not a European novel. I find it aids me in some way that I can't quite understand. Being away from the news, away from the press, living in a place like living in the middle of Paris, where, I mean, I'll look at the papers, I'll look at the French press, I won't understand much of what I see. I look at the French television, I don't understand much of that either. And you can live, if what you're interested in is working, which is what I do when I'm over there, you really kind of, you've got a funny self-created environment that's life on the margins. There is a practical side of life in Paris, which is the loveliness of the city. And if you're anything of a Sybarite at all, the food and the drink isn't bad either. The transportation system is the best in the world. The best in the world and the cheapest, I think, too. So the quotidian, the daily things of life, I think, are as easy as in any city in the world. And the rest of it, you get away from the press of things somehow.
Who are your friends in Paris? Because you said you don't speak the language well, which would seem to preclude having a lot of French.
Oh, no, mixed bag of Americans, English, French, Germans, who in any group of that kind, mostly the lingua franca is English. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes it'll be French. But mostly you get an international crowd around the table, and everybody will be speaking English. We will occasionally find ourselves in a thoroughly French crowd, which makes things very uncomfortable for me, not for my wife, whose French is fluent, but I'll find myself kind of on the outside of things. But it's sort of interesting, I mean, to sit at a table and kind of watch it all go by. I remember what Adlai Stevenson said. He said all he wanted to do when he lost the election lost that brief run in 1960, he said he wanted to sit under the shade of a tree with a glass of wine and watch the people dance. Well, that's all right. I don't mind sitting at a table with all this chatter going around me, having a glass of wine and dreaming away, I suppose. It's kind of agreeable.
Well, Americans I have seen have complained about French rudeness and contempt for Americans, but I've never had any problem. They've always courteous and polite.
French have got the worst rap of any national group. I know they are not any ruder than anybody else. In the height of the season, in the tourist season in Paris, you will find exasperated French all over the city. But I think everybody's exasperated in August. They're exasperated on Martha's Vineyard. I don't know why they shouldn't be exasperated on the Champs-Élysées. But the rest of the time in the non-tourist season, I mean, we find the French really quite agreeable. Of course, I have friends who tell me that I find them agreeable because I don't understand what they're saying to me when they're insulting me. I have heard that said, which may be another argument for not knowing the language very well.